You are Locked On Pacers, your daily Indiana Pacers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome in to the Locked On Pacers podcast. My name is Adam Friedman. As always, I'm a staff writer at IndyCornrows.com. And on today's show, I have fellow IndyCornrows writer Caitlin Cooper. We discuss all things Pacers and Cavs coming up for their Sunday game and the start of the first round of the NBA playoffs. I'm not going to do much of a preview here, but it's a great show. Take a listen to it. It's about 45 minutes long. I hope you enjoy it. Now, today's podcast with Caitlin Cooper.
Joining me now on the other line, Caitlin Cooper from IndyCornrows.com, fellow staff writer of mine, even an editor. Caitlin, how are you doing?
Good. Long time, no talk.
I think it's been since October, maybe.
Yeah, it's been a while. It was my fault, listeners, not Adam's. I've had... The first time I think you called, I was on like a road trip and I didn't think I was going to be able to do it. And then the next time when you offered me to come on, I was sick and had basically no voice. So
I do remember that. You kept saying, I was like, you know what? Don't worry about it. You come on when you feel better.
Yep. That's actually happened like twice in the last year. I don't know what my problem is with losing my voice. So
it's all right. I was eating a Clementine before this and my throat just started coughing all of a sudden. So I was afraid I was not going to talk either. So don't worry about it. So let's just get right into it. I guess now this will be posting on a Friday. So 2 nights ago, the Cleveland Cavaliers actually lost the Knicks, securing themselves in the 4 seed versus the Pacers, which means first round series, Pacers-Cavs. It starts this Sunday at 3:30. What's your initial thoughts on the series?
Well, initially, honestly, I was kind of hoping for a Sixers series, to be quite frank. But once it was Cleveland, I think everybody, I hear a lot today about, well, the Pacers played them tough. It was 3-1. It's like, yeah, but they didn't play this roster. And while I'm still not completely sold on Cleveland's overall, I mean, I think they'll probably win the East, but I'm not completely sold on what they're doing because their defense is still up in the air and their rotations are still up in the air. I look today and they don't even have a single rotation that's played more than 30 minutes in April, which 24 other teams have one or more and they don't even have one. So I mean, there's definitely question marks, but I don't think it's a great matchup for the Pacers, certainly with the way they're playing when Kevin Love's at five. So,
yeah, I would agree with you first on the Sixers point that I think everybody in Pacer Nation wanted them to play the Sixers. It was definitely a more favorable series just because the team was younger and going against LeBron, as the Pacers have learned, I think this is their fifth time in like 7 seasons of going against him in the playoffs, that you really just can't beat LeBron. But you hit a good point, though, that this really is a different team. You know, the Pacers may have beat 3 out of 4 of them, but they brought in at least 3 new starters. If not, they traded away 6 guys, I think, away the trade line. I mean, this is a completely different team, and it's really just LeBron now. And it's kind of what makes this team so scary is that no matter who they have, it's LeBron, and that's why they probably lose this series, right?
Right. I mean, yeah, clear. And the only Miles Turner's only played in 1 of the 4 games this year. And in the game he played with, I mean, they were trotting lineups out there. If you watch it back, they had lineups out there with Dwayne Wade, Crowder, and Jeff Green all at the same time. And those types of options just aren't going to be there. I mean, Victor Oladipo alone, it's so important to what they do defensively that he'd be able to roam. And there's just not going to be a real clear option to say, oh, yeah, he can roam off of that guy. Because they'll start Jeff Green, probably with Hill, Hood, LeBron, and Love, but you're going to have to hide Turner on Green because you don't really want Turner defending off-ball screens with Kevin Love, and you're going to want him to be able to stay in help position. So as far as Victor, I mean, you're not going to have him sagging off of George Hill or Rodney Hood. I mean, he's going to have to guard those people normally. So I just think there's some matchup issues there.
I would agree with you. I'm glad you brought up Miles Turner. For everybody out there, if you haven't checked it out, I read your article, your Miles Turner piece. And so I was actually intrigued when you said he should guard Jeff Green because I just thought he was going to guard Love, assuming Thaddeus Young is going to guard LeBron, right? So you kind of think that Bojan's going to end up guarding Love? That seemed like
Bogdanovich is going to guard LeBron. Thad will guard Love, and Turner will guard Green. I mean, that's mostly what they did through 4 games. If you look at the matchup numbers and if you watch them back, they had either Sabonis or Miles Turner guard Jay Crowder, and then they let them sag into the lane so that they wouldn't be involved in those off-ball picks. When they have Kevin Love in the corner and they use a guard to screen for him, that's just so tough for a big to be able to guard and either get back to that shooter or stay with Kevin Love rolling to the baseline or popping. So, I mean, I don't really think you want Miles Turner defending in space in that way. So that's what I will definitely watch. That's why I'm almost more intrigued for game two, because I want to see if they're going to continue to start Jeff Green. Because if they start with Miles Turner on Green and he's a non-shooting option, and now to Jeff Green's credit, he's been really good off of cuts this year, but they might end up countering and going even smaller just to see how Miles Turner will then have to switch on to Kevin Love and how he handles that.
See, I was on I understand they play a lot of Bojan on LeBron, but I was on the kind of the thought process that eventually they're going to have to probably play Thad a lot on LeBron, because he's the only guy that can probably face him up in any way where LeBron won't beat him at the rim. Because I think if you put Bojan on LeBron, LeBron's just going to beat him the rim every single time. And I was kind of – if they do that, I wonder if the first switch will be to put Thad on him.
Right. I mean, they do some of that side pick between LeBron and Love anyways. And I think the Pacers switched that some when they played. So then, yeah, I mean, it would be Thad. But I think they'll – I mean, Bogdanovich mostly played him. I mean, I'm not thrilled with it. I mean, that goes back to three important things that the Pacers have basically gotten away with. And that's one of them. They've gotten away with Bogey guarding the opposing team's top wing player. And, you know, he's taken strides, and I give him credit for being passable, but you have to wonder, like, how long is that going to work, especially like you just said. I mean, it's LeBron. And how long are they going to keep hitting – can they continue to hit open mid-range shots to – at a decent enough clip to combat? I mean, Cleveland's offense has just been a machine since Kevin Love came back. I mean, when they play Love next to LeBron, they're up over 130 points per 100 in those small lineups since Kevin Love came back from being hurt. I mean, all you can't stop that. You're just going to have to try to outscore it. So they're going to have as much offense on the floor as they can.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the mid-range thing later, but I want to keep hitting on this LeBron thing for one more point. And is that if the Pacers get more of a, let's say, a, what was it, early January Bojan, and get more of a, I don't know, a good Lance Stevenson, do you think there's any chance that Lance gets pushed in the starting lineup at some point if they're back against the wall, or he's just playing hot? Because he's the best – theoretically, he's the best defender on the team for LeBron on paper if you don't play Thad there.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, Lance and LeBron will get most of those minutes. The only thing that you get when you put Lance in the starting lineup is this is why the roaming advantage is going to work against the Pacers, because they'll just put LeBron on Lance and then just have LeBron roam off of him. Because – and since the All-Star break, I think Lance is shooting, like, what, 21% from three? I mean, and if they don't have them do that, then, I mean, I think LeBron will start out on Thad, because Thad's shooting just as poorly outside the paint. I mean, I think from three, Thad's, like, I have it written down here, 9 of 41 since the All-Star break. So, I mean, LeBron will definitely – that he will guard those two just so that he can be off them and be either taking extra steps toward Oladipo when he gets in the lane, or, I mean, he's the best at roaming in the NBA when he's focused and – actually, you know, no offense, but trying consistently on defense.
Yeah, so do you think he'll sort of, I mean, he's obviously going to turn it up, but do you think, you know, I think this year we've seen a lot of, like, lazy defensive LeBron, doesn't care, and a lot of times we always think he can turn it on, he turned on the past few years, but you don't think there's any chance that him playing this lazy all year with this, especially the guys he has around him, that it's not going to matter as much on defense because they're just not a good defensive team?
I mean, I think, yeah, I think some of that's true. I mean, I think that they definitely are just going to rely on all they have to do is be semi-passable, because their offense has just been that potent. But it will matter if they're sending multiple defenders at Oladipo, just because I haven't seen the Pacers really make that many adjustments to what teams have been doing when they're hedging and trapping Oladipo. I mean, I think that's a welcome invitation to send as many people as they can off those high picks towards him as possible. That's such a huge, crucial part of what the Pacers do offensively. I mean, my guess is that's probably why Green's going to be in the starting lineup, because they'll probably have Jeff Green guard Victor Oladipo. I mean, Ty Lue said as much last week when he was naming – when he named Jeff Green the starter, he mentioned Victor Oladipo as somebody that he could guard. So,
and
otherwise
–
yeah, otherwise I don't even –
Sorry. My bad. Keep going.
Yeah, otherwise I don't even really know why they would start Jeff, other than using his defensive versatility, because he's not going to give you enough offensively to make it worth it.
Yeah, and I think that's where Miles Turner comes in, actually, to be more important, is if they're going to double-team Vic, is what can he do? And you talk about that on sort of when he has the ball at the top of the key, is he going to be confident enough or feel or get hot enough to be able to just constantly hit his bucket from, let's say, the 15 to the outside three shot? Because if that's not falling, it's going to be kind of just a struggle to score points at times. Because I think Vic is ultimately going to be taken out of the game in some sense a little bit, just because if they're double-teaming nonstop, it's going to be hard to score.
Right. Miles has to hit those shots. He's got to be confident with it. And, you know, the last – I think I had in the article that he's missed 21 of his last 26 shots. And obviously he didn't look very confident against Charlotte when they went ahead and played him. That was kind of diminishing returns at a certain point. And even if he's not making the shots, he's got to make somebody commit to him so that he can make those little drop passes, the Thad hanging out on the baseline, or just make the right read. Because if he can't at that point, then they're going to have to go with Sabonis, just because we know right now that Sabonis makes a little bit better reads out of those situations. But, I mean, there's just other stuff that they could be doing that they don't do at a very regular clip. You know, they could use Collison to set screens for Turner before Turner sets the screen for Oladipo, and that's going to make Love later to get up there to hedge on Oladipo. And that if Oladipo has a head of steam, it's pretty hard to stop him. So, I mean, I just wish they would do some of those things a little bit more consistently, and I just don't really think that we've seen that since the All-Star break. I mean, maybe they're holding some of that back, but we'll see it on Sunday.
I'm thinking that – so one play I remember them running post All-Star break, because they haven't done a lot of, like you said, a lot of really unique off-ball actions, was one they ran a play for basically an off-ball pick for get Collison open with Thad Young. I think it was in the Miami game. And that sort of was something that I was like, oh, they can actually – McMillan actually knows how to do that kind of things, where it was an end-of-game situation and Vic had the ball. And it was like, instead of just relying on it to go to the rim, they set up basically Collison off the ball, which they could run with Bojan or anybody else, which is just kind of maybe – gave me hope that maybe Nate is sort of holding something back. You know, he knows that he's got to bring it in the playoffs. You know, he played this team last year. Maybe it's something working up. I don't know what it is, but maybe he does.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I remember you writing that article, because it can't just be a steady diet. As good as Vic has been in late game situations, you can't just continue to throw and expect his speed to get past multiple defenders. That can't be plan A, plan B, plan C. I mean, yeah.
I mean, he'll also get just exhausted. I mean, you saw a bit last year with Paul George, where they were playing George, I think, like 41 minutes a game in the playoffs. And you could just see by game four, he was just exhausted. I mean, you could see his legs are just not the same. And I know Vic's in great shape, and Vic has all the stuff they say, oh, he can keep up with that pace, but nobody can play, you know, 40 minutes a game and carry the load offensively and defensively and really be successful. It's just, I mean, LeBron's the closest guy that can do that. And that's because he's just a complete freak of nature athletically.
Yeah, I mean, that series, when you think about it, that has aged pretty well for Paul George last year, because they were consistently using Love or LeBron to guard Lance and roam over to Paul George. Paul George puts up pretty good offensive numbers, and he's having to guard LeBron on the other end. So looking back at how many non-shooters were on the floor with him, because, I mean, Kevin Love was guarding Monte even at times so that he could roam over to Paul George. So as much as people don't want to hear about him, that series has aged pretty well in time now, given what this roster looks like.
Yeah, and I would hope from that series that McMillan learned something. You know, he saw how you can't rely on one player, or saw how, you know, how quick he has to be with Lance. If Lance is not hitting his shot, he's got to just pull up. I mean, as good as his defense is, if he's not hitting his shot, he's useless almost, because the Cavs will just not pay attention to him. So hopefully he's learned a little bit of that. And, you know,
no, that's a really good point, because Lance actually took – I was looking back at numbers because I was looking at what Miles Turner did in the playoffs last year and kind of looking at his response and what he needs to do a year later. And that's a really good point, because Lance took the second most field goals out of anybody on the team last year, because he was just he just kept shooting and shooting to try to keep the defense honest. I mean, when they gave up that really big lead, I can't remember if it was game two or game three when they had that lead, it was just like him and Monte trading shots to try to get the defense to commit to them. And I mean, you're right. You're right, because if he's not consistently hitting those shots, like, he is a good defender against LeBron in those instances, but not if LeBron's not going to pay attention to him on the other end of the floor. So
yeah, it was game three. And I remember it was just painful. I mean, that was part of the Pacers team last year, which is why you said they've aged so well. Cause you look at last year's roster and it's like, they were playing Stuckey. I mean, I know they're in the playoffs, but in the race, they were playing Stuckey and they were playing Ellis and they were playing, you know, Lance, and those are just three just terrible shooters who don't create any space. And it's just
they were playing bench lineups with Monte, Lance, Lavoie, and Kevin Serafin all at the same time.
No,
that's
space.
The negative space lineup.
I mean, especially because this year, Tony and I talk about it a lot, is like, the reason this team is so good this year, because they finally figured out the spacing. I mean, all these guys, at least they have, they can all shoot when all their starters, they all can, you know, I know Thad, like you said, has not been great from three recently, but he's a threat sometimes, because he can hit the three. You think he can sometimes.
And, well, and at the very least with Thad, if I mean, just like in this series, they're probably not going to use him as the screener very much, because if LeBron's guarding him, they don't want LeBron to switch onto Oladipo or onto Collison. So, I mean, Thad can still be effective because he's just so good hanging out down there in the baseline in those box areas and being, you know, the guy that either cleans up messes. I mean, he just really is the glue guy. So, I mean, he can still be effective even if he can't step out, because they're not really going to use him to pop that much anyways.
Right. They're going to put George Hill on Oladipo probably, right?
No, I would imagine it's Jeff Green, because, I mean, Ty Lue basically said that like a week ago, that he was going to put Jeff Green or keep Jeff Green in the starting lineup. And when he mentioned players that he could guard, he mentioned Victor Oladipo as a top person, that this is why we need Jeff Green. So I would imagine that George Hill will guard Collison.
Okay, so then basically, right, you're never going to run the screen. You said you like the idea of running Collison with the screen, but is there anybody else? I'm trying to think if they run the screen with Turner maybe. Like that's where Sabonis maybe becomes valuable if they replace him with Turner, because he's a better screener. And if you're putting Kevin Love into that pick and roll a lot, that's probably the right move, I guess, over and over again probably.
Right, and he just makes really good reads. I mean, they're going to have to look and see, because Cleveland's rotations are usually fairly poor, so you just have to look to see whenever either Sabonis or Turner catches it there at the free throw line, who's committing to them. Like, are they going to send an extra person over there? Are they going to leave it open and force them to make them shoot? I mean, because Kevin will consistently show on Oladipo, because that's how they use him in almost every matchup. They usually have him hedge for a time and then recover back to the shooter. So,
okay, so then I'll move on to a little different topic, more about coaching. So, first of all, do you think the Pacers have the advantage in coaching? I want to know where your views are on Ty Lue and Nate McMillan. Do you think they have the advantage?
I mean, I think Nate definitely has the respect, and he's gotten the chemistry together with this team. Like, you have to give him tons of credit for getting everybody to buy in, and their culture and their environment sees so good. And on the flip side with Ty Lue, I mean, he has the benefit of being able to say, you know, I coached this team to a championship, but there's just, I think the pressure difference is a lot different there, because, you know, LeBron could be leaving and what that tension's going to be like between player and coach, and what the rest of the roster's feeling. I mean, as a tactician, to be honest, I haven't paid probably close enough attention in late game situations beyond some of the games with Cleveland where they've called that same play that they ran against the Pacers and the Wizards, where LeBron's taken those like deep turnaround heaves. I've seen some of that, but I mean, I think just from the standpoint that everybody buys into what Nate McMillan's message is, and they all buy into what their role is. And I would lean towards Nate, I think, just in a coaching standpoint. But I mean, I'm still not convinced in what they've done off, like what I said earlier, the hedges and traps. I'm not sure those adjustments have been there, but like I said, maybe they're holding some of that back in anticipation of what they're going to have to see against Cleveland.
So that was basically a long answer for Nate is probably slightly better.
Yeah.
Right. So then the more important question is how can the game of trading, basically, you know, we talked about the Pacers take a ton of mid-range shots. You know, is that effective against Cleveland if you're trading twos for threes? You know, or is it you trust your defense to stop them enough in the three-point shot? Or maybe you're just trusting that they don't have – I mean, they have good three-point shooters. They don't have, like, outside of Korver, and they don't have, like, these exceptional three-point shooters. Are you just betting that you can just make more twos and they can make threes in the numbers game, whatever?
Right, I don't know. They have a lot of shooting threats. That's why I said there's not going to be a clear place to let Victor Oladipo roam off of. I mean, I don't know if they can trade twos for threes, because if Victor struggles to roam at all, it's going to be hard to force turnovers, and that's usually been their great equalizer in that regard. They've been able to get away with trading twos for threes because they take more shots than their opponent a lot of games, because they're so good at thriving in the open floor and fast break situations and in points off turnovers. So, I mean, a lot of it, I look at it defensively. If it looks like in game one that Victor's getting into passing lanes and being able to force turnovers and that Thad's getting deflections, then it might work as long as they continue to hit the mid-range shots at a decent clip. If they don't, I mean, Cleveland's offense is just a blazing inferno right now. So,
yeah, I wonder how they attack, because the best thing about LeBron is that he can make a pass from anywhere on the court to anybody. And I wonder how they attack, like you said, with closing off lanes. So if they can figure out how to sort of, like, you know, LeBron rarely misses the pass, it feels like. But if they can find a way, because they've been so good at getting Thad to cut off a pass somehow, getting Oladipo to cut a pass, that might be like the complete X factor in the series.
Yeah, I mean, just like in late in games, when LeBron has the ball, a lot of times they'll send a shooter to set a quick screen for Kevin Love in the corner. When they're that spread out, there's just not a lot of opportunity for people to sag into the paint to do that. But I mean, Victor's just so freaking quick that, you know, it's possible. And LeBron does make on occasion some kind of cavalier passes now and again for
nice pun.
Yeah, my pun was semi-intended, but I mean, we'll just have to see.
Yeah, you know, I agree. LeBron does make some mistakes, but I just remember from last year's series particularly is how he killed them, especially in that game where they came back, where he was just like basically being point guard of LeBron. It was like get two guys to run at him, and then he just kicks it all the way around the court. Basically, like he'll be on one end of the court and throw all of the other 3-point line. But you are right. Victor does have some unique defensive skills that I think even to bring up Paul George didn't have, where he is just always seemed like he's looking to cut off the pass. Like he sometimes he overdoes it and like misses the ball and the guy beats him, but sometimes it works. And this year it's obviously worked a ton for him. That's why he has so many steals. So I'm just trying to figure out how, you know, who they can put him on. You talk about they have so many 3-point shooters and they might not be able to, but how they can get him into that kind of role.
Yeah, I mean, my guess is they'll start him on Hood defensively. Okay. But
that makes sense because Hood's still a decent 3-point shooter, right? I'm gonna look up his percentage.
He's been here in the last, I want to say the last month, he's been around 30. It hasn't been great, but I know he's been in and out of the lineup with a couple different injuries. But I mean, their only other option would be Jeff Green. But at that point, first of all, you're giving up size. And secondly, then you're going to be making Turner defend in space and be defending those picks with Kevin Love. And I just don't think you want to do that. I just don't think there's a really good option. I mean, Victor's just going to have to be all over the place. There's just not a really good place for him to roam off of in their bench groups or in their starting lineup, which I guess at this point, who really knows what their bench group's going to be because they've had to run so many different lineups because of injuries and people coming back and forth.
So do you think a Pacer player is the third best player in the series behind Depot and LeBron, or do you think it's the Cavs player? So is it like Turner or some Young or somebody, or is it like Love?
It's Kevin Love.
So you don't think there's any chance that Miles Turner, as I take Miles Turner's best stretch this season, is that at Love's level maybe?
Well, like Miles Turner, for instance, was really good in that Philly game, I thought, whenever they clinched the tiebreaker. I mean, he was probably the best player that night for the Pacers. I mean, not probably. He was the best player for the Pacers that night overall. But, yeah, I mean, I just think, especially with the importance of what Kevin Love does and how good he's been since he came back, that even at Turner's ceiling this year, I don't think he's going to be better than Kevin Love. But if he just does what he can do well, that'll give the Pacers more of a chance. I mean, if he comes out and he still isn't confident with his shot and he's hasty making those reads, because he can kind of get in this in-between space where he's tentative, but he plays rushed all at the same time. Like, he can get on the block and have a smaller guy there, and it's like, I'm going to rush and take this really quick hook shot. But at the same time, he's tentative to even go to the block and do it. Like, I don't even know how important it is for him to get those switches because, I mean, the real importance is that he's going to be able to hit those shots whenever teams hedge on Oladipo. But, I mean, you just want him to be more just at this. He needs to be aggressive and calm all at the same time this year, which he really wasn't a year ago until three games into the series.
Yeah, well, one, you would hope the playoff experience, he's now played in 11 playoff games, so maybe that helps him kind of calm those nerves just a little bit. I mean, he started 2 years for this team already in the playoffs. That's an accomplishment itself for a guy who's only 21. But I do agree with you that if you watch him play, he just does this thing where, like, he's a really good shooter sometimes. Like, there was a stretch where he was shooting really well, but he didn't just hesitate. Like, he gets the ball and kind of freezes for just a split second, and then it's like the whole play is ruined. If he just gets that ball and either
confidently shoots it, yep,
or even passes it, like, quick pass. Like, it's when he freezes that everything, you know, is going bad. And you can see it in his eyes, too, because he gets the ball and he overthinks himself. And it's kind of been his thing his first 2 years, too, was, you know, I remember there was one time his rookie year where he made the wrong pick and went, like, rolled the wrong way to the rim. And you could just tell he was in his head too much. He wasn't letting his body take over almost. He wasn't, like, playing the game like a basketball player. He's playing like a guy who's trying to think about where he needs to be and all that stuff. And he just needs to play something, like, get out of his own head.
Yeah, I mean, it was obvious that they wanted to play him in that Hornets game so he could get some of his confidence back and see some shots go down. And then clearly that, you know, didn't transpire. And you could kind of see with each passing miss that he was getting a little bit more and more frustrated. So I'm kind of going to be interested to see, does that Does that kind of shock him into being ready from the tip in game one, or is his confidence kind of knocked from the way he shot the ball the last four games? I mean, I wonder if what Nate McMillan thought after the game, if he questioned whether he should have just sat him out for rest or what, because you definitely don't want him going into the playoffs having missed 21 of his last 26 shots.
The thing is, though, if he hits his first three or his first two shots, that 21-20 thing goes out the window. It stops mattering, basically.
Well, he made his first shot, I think, against Charlotte the other night, and then proceeded to miss like the next eight. But he had the really bad night earlier in the season, and then I think that's whenever Victor Oladipo went over to his house, or that was reported. I don't remember what it was, but then he came into Miami and was like a house of fire. So, you know, I could turn around, but I would have just rather he came into the game with a little bit more confidence than what he's going to have after the last little rough stretch he's had.
I remember that we're talking about, because that was like, I remember there was kind of a big deal and he came out and I think Whiteside maybe didn't play and he just came out and like, it went like 10 of 14, like one of those like signature kind
of. Yeah, it was one of his probably best games.
I just wonder though, you know, they are fortunate. They have Sabonis, who I know has been kind of, he's easing back from injury at least, or kind of, it's been kind of shaky, and he played pretty well. He played really well on Sunday. And I wonder if, you know, there was a one point where it seemed like Sabonis was going to maybe steal Turner's starting job, and that went away pretty quickly. But I wonder if there's a quick trigger. It's like, the problem is they need Turner so much defensively, but I wonder if there's a quick trigger on the offensive end that, like, we got to play Sabonis and Oladipo together because they're so good together.
Yeah, I mean, I think at a certain point it's a bit of a trade-off, because if you don't really think you're going to be able to stop the LeBron Love at center lineups that well anyways, and you're going to have to fight offense with offense, and if Turner's shot isn't falling, Sabonis is going to give them more as a passer and making reads and as a screener and just making Kevin Love have to defend him in pick and roll situations, rolling to the basket, than Turner's going to give. So, I mean, Nate's had a fairly short leash with Turner a lot this year anyways. I mean, there's been several fourth quarters that they've opted to play Sabonis over him. So we'll see. I mean, you definitely want both of them, because you don't want to have to go to Al Jefferson, and I don't think you really want to go to the Booker Thad backup lineups either. So,
and then that's kind of actually another point I wanted to hit is, who do you see playing more, or maybe you don't see either of them playing, Booker and Glenn Robinson?
Well, if GR3 can continue to be confident with his shot, there's a place for him to play in this series. I mean, then as far as Booker, I mean, that I've poked at that all bench unit, but they actually haven't been that bad the last 2 weeks. I think they have a positive net rating with Corey Joseph and Lance and Glenn and Booker and Sabonis. And it's going to depend on what Cleveland does, because sometimes they get weird and they play Nance and Thompson together. And if Nance and Thompson are on the floor, you can probably get away with still playing Trevor Booker and trying to, you know, I mean, the way that bench unit's been having a positive net rating is because they're just getting every rebound available, basically. And because their defense really hasn't been that good. Like, since they've started playing in this month, I think they're giving up like 107 points, which is surprisingly really bad, probably because they're giving up a lot of threes, but
I remember you tweeting about that bench unit, and they immediately went on some great run.
I know. No, this is my life. Like, I should tweet negative things all the time, because the minute I do, they turn around. Like, ever since then, they haven't been that bad, honestly.
I just don't know if I trust him in the playoffs.
No, I don't trust that, you know. It's been helpful, like I said. It helps their overall functionality if Glenn Robinson can shoot more like Glenn Robinson. But, I mean, we have over 1,000 minutes of evidence that Corey and Lance in general playing together has been, I think it's up over negative 100 in total plus minus for the season now. And I don't think Booker and Sabonis can guard the three-point line all that well, though Booker's a little bit more mobile and has a little bit better principles than some of those double big lineups they played last year. So, yeah, and there just isn't spacing all that well.
That Joseph Lance stat is just interesting, because they just don't seem to have any other options why they keep playing it. And I just wonder if there's some option of playing somehow Collison more with the bench. They've been playing Vic a lot of the
quarter and fourth. Like, if they would have pulled anybody in the first round other than Cleveland, I think they should have started Corey Joseph and brought Darren Collison to juice the bench and run the bench's offense. But, I mean, with Cleveland, you have to fight fire with fire and have as much offense in the starting lineup as you possibly could. But if they would have played the Wizards, or if they would have played the Sixers, or even the Heat, I would have written that column that they need to start Corey Joseph, simply because the starting lineup's even been better with Corey Joseph than it's been with Darren Collison the entire season.
I also wonder if there's a way you try to stagger it so Vic is on the court when James is not a little bit, and you're allowing Lance to play out there, and you're just praying that Lance can just continually stop James almost. I know it's like a long shot, but like you almost wonder that if you get Vic playing against the Cavs bench, I think he'll just feast. I think he'll have a great time, but I think they're going to try to mirror James and him together. Like the Cavs will, because obviously that kind of is an intimidation factor in some sense. But if they could figure out how to get Vic with playing against the Cavs bench a little bit, and maybe hope Lance and GR3 and some Booker, maybe that could just out-rebound, get every rebound, and just play really good D, that could be an option to sort of help the bench unit a little bit, because the bench unit is just not that good sometimes. I feel like it's sort of like,
right,
it's always like a page bench. You're shaky on it. You're kind of, you go into it and you're worried that either they're going to blow the 10-point lead you have, or they're going to blow the tie game you have and make it a 15-point game.
Yeah, I don't really believe in the all bench unit sustainability. I mean, Cleveland's bench hasn't been great, and you're accurate, because their defense in general has been their bigger problem. But I mean, that's in April, and that's their aggregate bench net rating. And they've just had so many different bench lineups, because every night it seems like they're having to play a different lineup, because George Hill had I don't remember if it was the foot or the ankle. What did he just have? He had one of those two things. And then Hood was out for a while, and obviously Kevin Love was out, and then a couple other people. Seti, I think, has been in and out for them. So, I mean, it's anybody's guess what their bench rotation is going to be on Sunday.
Yeah, I almost wonder if the lack of chemistry will help the Pacers maybe in the series. Because the Pacers have basically played the same team all year. They brought in one new player, Booker. Robinson, I guess, was brought in say from injury, but they've had the same roster. They have this like really unique chemistry. I think everybody can kind of see it and watch them enough. I wonder if the Cavs not having this chemistry will help them, but also then again, it's LeBron, and LeBron is LeBron James.
Right. I mean, I think their general formula with what they do with the starting lineup and how they use LeBron and Love is going to be fairly constant, but I think there's definitely adjustment period. I think Fear the Sword had a pretty good article on LeBron being the system. If people want to check it out, I think they wrote it a couple months ago, but it was really good just explaining how long it took Kyle Korver to adjust to playing with LeBron. And, Korver's been good for them, but it was an adjustment period to learning how to play off of him. So, yeah, I mean, there might be a little bit of that just because they had a ton of roster turnover. And just like I said, with people being in and out, they don't have a single unit in the last month that's played 30 minutes. So we'll see. I mean, their offense is still just stellar, but
so outside of LeBron and Love, is Korver the scariest offensive player just purely because he could probably hit 10 threes at any moment, or is JR, or are you looking at somebody else as kind of a really scary offensive player?
Yeah, I mean, really, it could be George Hill, it could be JR, it could be Korver, Calderon. Well, I know George Hill's taking steps back, but my main point was going to be that anytime LeBron has the ball in his hands, all you really have to do as any of those guys is stand and wait to be able to shoot the shot that he serves up to you on a silver platter. So you don't know who's going to be the scariest of that group on any given night. I mean, I don't think George Hill looks the way that he did in Indiana, but I don't think the Cavs necessarily need him to be that.
Yeah, I mean, Pacer fans probably remember the George Hill who at least had two or three good games against the Raptors. He was just hitting every corner three, it seemed like, for a while.
Yeah, I mean, that's been, I think he's just had so many between like the turf toe and the other issues. Sometimes it doesn't look like he's very confident in planting his foot. And sometimes too, in the first weeks, it might be somewhat of an adjustment, but he'd dribble off a screen and it didn't always seem like there was a lot of a plan beyond that. Like it was either because he didn't look confident jumping off of his foot to actually go into the paint, and then it was just a little bit aimless. So he doesn't quite look like himself through all the injuries that he went through in Utah and just coming off the ankle injury. But, I mean, they don't necessarily need him to be the blonde George Hill that the Pacers had or even the George Hill that Utah had, as long as he can stand there and hit shots.
Yeah, the blonde George Hill. Wow, that brings back some days, some memory of that just, I don't want to call it not good-looking hair, but just that hair, which is bad. If you had a handicap, it Pacers win over under 1.5 game in the series.
Well, I definitely think game one is their best chance. If they can go out and get game one with Jeff Green in the starting lineup and see what they do with that, they might I might be able to take the over and say they could get two. If they don't get game one before the Cavs make adjustments, I'm tired of doubting this team, so I guess I can say that they'll get two. Because okay. I don't want to be the person that was me in August doubting what the roster is going to be able to do
but,
with
you know,
my bad preseason takes.
But clearly, we were, first of all, everybody was wrong, so that's not just you. I think I said they were going to win 28 games, so everybody was wrong. But you said it yourself. When you say one thing, they do the opposite. So maybe it's better that you say they're not going to win over one half game. But I think you're right that game one is their best chance, because if you look back, even history against LeBron for the Pacers, it was, I mean, the Heat series, they won one of those first two games, but every time they established that they were, you know, when they really took LeBron at least to six or seven, that they were kind of a team to least fear when they came out in game one and were just really good. And even last year, they had a shot to win game one somehow, and they probably should have, you know, CJ Miles should hit that 15-footer every time, to be honest. He's wide open. He should hit that. But,
you're right, definitely, because, I mean, they were way closer in those games than they should have been a year ago, given what roster they had. And, I mean, basically what I'm looking at is there's so many matchup issues that I question here, but I'm just going off the pure strength of what they've been this year. I mean, they go within themselves. They have all these comeback wins. I mean, I think they'll come out highly motivated. Plus they have the extra motivation of the whole Dan Gilbert, Kevin Pritchard reneging on the trade. Dan Gilbert saying, I can't believe they accepted that. Now Victor Oladipo is going to be playing in his arena. So that's kind of an interesting little extra.
Yeah, that is a great angle. I actually completely forgot about it. There's been so much stuff about the, I mean, there was so much stuff said about that trade. That thing probably just completely escaped my mind. I probably missed that whole thing.
Yeah, and I don't remember what Dan Gilbert's exact words were, but I think I remember at the time that he said something like, I can't believe that's what they were willing to accept. And then it was reported that Kevin Pritchard reneged on that deal. So we'll see.
That sounds completely familiar. I don't remember what he exactly said, but that sounds right. I think they have a shot at winning probably two games if they can somehow win both of their – win game two and three or game three and four basically, because if they go down 3-1 back to Cleveland, they aren't coming back.
I mean, yeah. I mean, Kevin Love, why did I say that? I mean, LeBron's won 21 straight games in the first round, so those are fairly daunting odds. It's not the same roster. They don't have Kyrie and whatnot, but
– You also look at it too. Last year, like you said, if you played those games out over and again, they only lost by 16 points combined in four games. Like, they should have won at least one of those.
Yeah. Well, at least the one where they blew the 23-point lead where Monte and Lance were on the floor at the same time while the lead got smaller and smaller and smaller in the third quarter without taking any timeouts.
Yeah, and they didn't play Kevin Love or Kyrie during that stretch. It was just LeBron.
That's so brutal. I'm sad that we remembered that. I wish our brains weren't capable of remembering that.
I know. It's just like so painful to remember. It's just like, it's one of those things I will probably never forget it ever. I won't forget that. I won't forget the LeBron layup that won against the Heat.
With the endless debates of whether Roy Hibbert should have been in the game or not.
Just that. I remember every moment of how George over hedged on like the jump shot and just basically missed LeBron and LeBron had a wide open blow to the rim. And I just couldn't believe that they didn't play Roy Hibbert. Those things just never, like, they could win a championship and those two games will just be on my mind forever.
Right. I mean, I remember too, the series. Now, this is how many times LeBron has broken the Pacers' hearts, because when Paul George got hit in the head in that game two
in
2014, and they had a lead at that point. And then afterwards he's like basically acting like he blacked out for a time and he was still playing. And then they ended up losing game two, but they had the opportunity that they could have gone up 2-0.
No, I'm convinced that if they were going to win that game until he got kneed in the head, and that would have went up 2-0, and they at least would have forced a game seven back in Indianapolis, which they could have had a shot at winning. You talk to me, I'm thoroughly convinced about that. I don't say it a lot, but I'm convinced that that knee in the head basically flipped that series.
It's definitely a one of those what ifs that you have to look back on. I mean, they weren't that great when they played down in Miami. I remember one of those losses was pretty bad.
Yeah, but they were so good at home that year.
They were good in game one.
Yeah, they came out and that's what I mean about the Pacers. And they have to come out and sort of like, I think there's even, you know, the Cavs had lost to them three out of four times. There's still this kind of idea, oh, they're the Pacers. They're not that good. They're the average team of the NBA. And they have to come out and sort of like basically hit the Cavs in the mouth and say, we're serious, and that's what they kind of done sometimes against LeBron. Hopefully they can do it again in game one.
Yeah. I think some of this stems from the fact that a lot of people, because the Pacers weren't on national TV this year, it's kind of hard to understand why they were good this year. Like, I think some people are still so mystified by how they were a decent regular season team that they question, that it's easy to question. And there is some merit to those questions of whether they can continue to do that in the playoffs. I mean, because like I said, between the mid-range shots and how they've used Bogdanovich and how teams have doubled Oladipo, those are three pretty big questions of whether those are going to be sustainable in a playoff situation. But I mean, they've just been greater than the sum of their parts. So you have to respect them on that alone.
Yeah, I mean, I question it sometimes. I sometimes laugh at, like, how did this team win that game? I mean, the amount of close games that they managed to win, or the games that you have your comeback list, like the amount of times they were down 15 points, I'm like, they're going to somehow win this game still. Like, it's just kind of dumbfounding.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, every time they got in a big hole, I was like pretty much thinking, well, what am I going to do with this game? Because once I started that, I had to continue it.
Yeah. And how you know how long the list is now? How many games do you have on that list?
Eight.
Okay. I feel like there's been more, but maybe it's just like there's some pretty glaring ones too, just like the Denver one stuff.
Yeah, and the Boston one could have been, if not for the turnover at the end of game, because they were down by more than 15 points in that game.
And I remember Denver just 2 weeks ago, they came back and had the lead, and they should have won that game. And they were down, I think, 15 or 21 points. I mean, it just, the thing about this team is they don't give up. So like, even if the Cavs go up 20, there is still a part of my mind that says this team can still come back, because they're not going to like just go away. That's the one thing about this team versus last year is there's just so much fight in this team versus last year's team that felt like it was like they were looking for a reason just to like basically throw in the towel.
Well, there was just a lot of games on the road last year where it didn't really seem like they were in it from the start. That was probably the most frustrating part. It's just like, I remember the one game in Charlotte towards the beginning of the series, when Paul George said afterwards that they had a lifeless performance. There was just too many of those where it didn't seem like they had any fight from minute one, let alone if they got in a hole.
And I love how Paul George said lifeless performance, like it wasn't his fault. Like it was the team's fault. There was such a locker room dynamic issue last year too. And you can just see it this year that the guys, like, nobody throws anybody under the bus. I mean, you talk about that Boston play, like nobody blamed Bojan, even though it was probably his fault. Nobody blamed him, and they all moved on from it. And it's kind of good to see this team just can be completely different dynamic. And like, they care about each other in a way. I really doesn't seem like that way since, like, you know, that famous picture of the George Hill, Paul George, Lance Stevenson, David West team.
Yeah. Where they're all at the podium.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just seemed like this team has some of that same chemistry that team had early on. It kind of faded after late in the time, but it seemed like early on those five guys from the 2012-13 team range, and the guys now have that same kind of like closeness at least.
Right. I mean, yeah. I mean, in the beginning that was true. Cause I mean, I wasn't thinking of the GQ photo when you said that. I was thinking about in 2012 when they all went to the podium after they beat the Knicks. I try to forget the GQ photo.
You not tweet a lot? Maybe it's somebody else who's a lot on Twitter. I feel like I see it on my timeline a ton.
I try to ignore it. Maybe I should mute GQ Pacer.
Whitney does it a ton. Whitney probably does it a ton.
Yeah, I think I did tweet it once last summer whenever it was just – I just thought it was funny that of all the people in the picture, Lance is the last one standing. I did have that.
Well, it's because he came back. I mean, he was just begging to get back on this team.
Well, basically, yeah.
Let's do the last question. I know you're kind of on time crunch, so we've gone, I think, almost 45 minutes now. So if they win this series, what's the, like, I know it's kind of maybe naive to say, what's the one thing you really think they have to do if they're going to pull out the upset?
The one thing, well,
it's tough. I know it's a tough question. I didn't mean to put you on the spot like that. It's just,
I think a lot of, like I wrote this morning, that's why I wrote what preview I did. I think a lot of it's going to rest on how Miles Turner can adjust to how the Cavs are going to be on both ends of the floor. Is, you know, can he stay in help position off Green? And if Green isn't in the starting lineup, can he handle doing it how he's going to have to defend Kevin Love? And on the other end of the floor, can he help Oladipo be what Oladipo is going to need from him? And then just how they react to the traps. If they can set some RAM screens, do some other creative things, set pin downs on the weak side to try to distract, you know, solid one pass away defense, and just really get the Cavs defense moving that's already questionable, then that's what they're going to have to do. Both of those things are going to, and they're just going to have to hit those open mid-range shots that they've been hitting this season.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. Myles Turner was in my mind, the most important thing to their playoff success. Anything you want to promote, plug before we finish this up?
No, I mean, right now, I don't think I'll probably have, unless something major happens, I probably won't have another thing beyond just if people want to read my player preview on Myles Turner that went up this morning, that's probably still on the front page unless somebody else, or near the top of the front of the page, unless somebody else had something posted. So they can go check that out. And then after game one, I'll probably have something if there's adjustments that need to be made.
Well, I believe as of like 5:30 when we got on this podcast, it was the first story on IndyCornrows.com. So you can check Kaylin out there. I guess this will be her last word before the series. So this is the last time you're going to, I guess, hear, unless you follow on Twitter. You want to promote your Twitter?
Oh, yeah. That's at C2_Cooper. And people will probably get annoyed with my number of screenshots that I like to send. But that's just who I am. So you'll just have to deal with it.
It's all right. Tony and I joke if you want to be part of a smart Twitter, you definitely have to follow you. So people should go ahead and do that.
Oh, that isn't my last word. My last word, I'm hijacking the pod because I was supposed to be able to come on in October or whenever that was. And you guys were supposed to tell me what the bet was about me following Tony. So now I need to know.
Oh my God. We've had so many bets. I don't even remember. I just lost an over under bet for 4.5 wins.
Or there was some like pod intrigue about whether I was going to follow Tony or not.
Okay. So the intrigue was you followed me on Twitter and Tony's like, why did I get the follow back? I'm like, I don't know. Why didn't you just ask? And he didn't want to ask. And eventually it happened. That was the intrigue, I think, if I remember.
Well, right. I think I initially followed you because I work with you. And then exactly. I think I just assumed that I followed Tony because I see all of his stuff on the timeline all the time. It definitely wasn't intentional.
Well, it's probably because we follow some of the same people and we like a lot of his content. So he probably just pops up anyways all the time.
I was just always seeing his tweets. So I think I just assumed that I was following him until finally he did say something. And I was like, oh, I guess I thought I was.
It's all right. He got over it, I guess. You know, we'll have to go back and listen. I don't remember what if we made a bet. We've made a lot of bets on a lot of things in this podcast this year. We do this 5 times a week sometimes. So a lot of things are said and a lot of things are forgotten right away too.
Keep it up. That's a lot of content to do in a week. So.
Thanks again, Kaylin, for joining today's Locked On Pacers podcast. As always, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at Locked On Pacers, me at Friedman Adam 5, my co-host Tony at Teased NBA. We'll be back together tomorrow. We'll have a show for Saturday Mailbag Edition. And so Tony and I are going to be doing a special Sunday Edition podcast, crossover pod with Locked On Cavaliers, Chris Banning probably. Look forward to those two podcasts. And, of course, the Pacers play Sunday, 3:30 p.m. sharp. We'll look for a podcast right for that game. Probably a fourth quarter podcast during that game. We'll post that night or Monday morning. And there'll be tons of content as the Pacers open up their first round of the NBA playoffs. That's all I got for today's Locked On Pacers podcast. I really hope you enjoyed this one. Have a great rest of your day.